You're listening to All Things Git, a podcast that talks about the very popular Git version control system and talks to the people who build it, build tools on top of it, and makes their teams successful using it. My name is Edward Thompson.
I'm Martin Woodward.
And since this is the first episode, I think we should introduce ourselves. Martin?
Yeah, sounds good. Hey. Yeah, so I'm Martin. I work over at a small IT company in the Seattle area called Microsoft. Been involved in Git for a few years now. I'm trying to think when it was when we got started, Ed. When was that? 2007-8-ish was when we started looking at Git seriously.
Right.
You know, we were looking at distributed version control. And then about 2010 was when we got really involved with Git, I think. So, so been involved with the Git for a while. But I feel like I'm probably going to be the Dr. Watson to Ed being the Sherlock Holmes of Git, because I'll hopefully be asking a lot of, you know, Basil exposition questions, because I'm a manager as a day job, and while I use Git extensively in my spare time and use Git at home and use Git in work, I'm probably a fairly normal developer in that I just use enough Git to get by. I have no idea. If you ask me to open up the .git folder inside the Git repo and then like navigate my way around, I'd get lost very, very, very quickly.
And actually, the .git folder is where I feel most at home, perhaps.
That explains the main difference between me and you. I use these things called Git commands. Well, I use Stack Overflow to help tell me the Git commands.
Stack Overflow is wonderful. It tells you how to use Git.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm also a program manager at Microsoft, and I work
but not really. You're a dev, really.
I don't know. I used to be a dev. I used to write software at GitHub and Microsoft and SourceGear and been focusing on version control for a really long time. I'm also the maintainer of libgit2. And if you've never heard of libgit2, it's a library that lets you twiddle the low level bits inside your Git repository. And even if you haven't heard of it, you've probably used it because it runs all the hosting providers. It runs GitHub and Visual Studio Team Services. And so I actually wrote the code that probably merges your pull requests. So
there we go.
Yeah.
So that's the big difference between me and you. Your major contribution was adding the merge logic to libgit2. The addition I made to libgit2 was removing Linus Torvalds swear words. So there we go. That explains our two roles.
And that is still my favorite pull request in the entire project.
We'll link to it in the show notes.
Absolutely. So what are we doing here? Why do we have a podcast about Git? So Git's become this critical part of software development and DevOps, and I actually think we should celebrate that and talk to the people who use it and build it. What I don't want to do, though, and there's an excellent podcast that does this already, and it's called Git Minutes. It's by a guy named Thomas Ferris Nicolaisen, and it's a wonderful podcast, but it's super low level. He talks to the people who build Git, and he talks about the features that they're implementing in Git itself, you know, like changing the default heuristics for Git diff around indentation. Right. Yeah. And it's great, awesome. But it's the sort of podcast that really digs in really deep on a specific feature. And I think that we should do something that talks to the more broad Git community, the people using Git and who are struggling with Git.
Okay. Sounds good. But we can always link to Git Minutes when we want to. I was on Git Minutes ages ago now. But yeah. So we can definitely mention when there is a new show, because there's not that many of them either. So
no, unfortunately, there's not.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. Sounds good. So who are we going to talk to this week?
Today, we've got Brennan Forster.
Yay.
And Brennan is a senior engineer at GitHub. Friend of mine. He works with Git tooling and other assorted open source projects. Hi, Brendan.
Good afternoon, Ed.
So how's things going with you, Brendan? People might know you as ShiftKey as well, so we should probably say that.
Yes, I'm ShiftKey on Twitter and GitHub.
But not the producer or the what else are you not?
Oh, that's a long-running joke that I should try and explain why I'm here. I travel a lot for work, and in my various sorts of travels, I've had people think that I am a pilot because of how I travel that much. and I also share a handle with a famous DJ. I am neither of those people. I just write code for GitHub, and I just clocked up 4 years at GitHub this week.
Wow.
So, and all that time has been dealing with various sorts of Git things that come up and dealing with things that get installed on people's machines aside from GitHub, the website.
So you work on GitHub desktop, is that right?
Correct.
And have you always worked on that at GitHub?
Yeah, actually. Yeah, so that's been primarily my baby, and I've been with a team on that for a while. And I also jump around with various sorts of other things at GitHub because of my background with Windows.
Okay. So I know you through like MVP stuff and through .NET stuff because I used to help with the .NET Foundation. So you GitHub Desktop's gone through a transition recently of having...
Yes.
Do you want to explain some of the history of it? Because there used to be lots of different versions of GitHub Desktop, and now there's like one...
We can start back from the very beginning.
Yeah, let's do that.
So, in the beginning, the first version of GitHub, we just literally called it GitHub app back in the day, was done for Mac OS. We had a team at startup with that, and then we decided that we would do a Windows version of the app. And so I was involved with the start of that, but I came in about 2 years into that, and it was written in C#. And so we trundled along for a little bit, but the two teams were very different, and they had different philosophies about things, different philosophies about what should be built, and they eventually decided that this was kind of silly having two teams building the same app in two different ways. So one of the things that happened when I started was that we became one team and we rebranded the thing as Desktop. So we had a goal for like bringing the apps together because they were two different code bases. It wasn't quite possible to do that easily, but we started off doing a big visual update for things to make sure that you download the app, whether it's for Mac or Windows, that you get the same set of features and that it looks and fits in nicely on the platform. So that was like stage one of the process. And then over time, we tried to keep two apps going and we kind of decided that it really wasn't worth it. And so for the work that we would do, we'd have to do the same thing in two different code bases. And for a team that wasn't as big as you might imagine, yes, there's a whole bunch of work and not really much in the way of like actually getting stuff done and giving value out for our users. So then we decided to look at cross-platform technologies, and there's a blog post about this stuff that came up as part of our announcement. We chose Electron over various sorts of other cross-platform technologies out there because we have a team at GitHub that does Electron. We also have a team that does Atom, cross-platform application for working with code. So we decided to use their skills and pull in our experience with Git and build GitHub Desktop on Electron. And we launched that a couple of months ago, I think, as a public beta. And the other thing to note is that it's all open source now. So you can come in, contribute to code, have a look at stuff. We have a Linux fork that people are working on at the moment that we're trying to get in. But ultimately, yes, that's kind of been my journey at GitHub, and there is still lots to do.
Wow. So you started out working on GitHub for Windows, and it was a C# app.
Correct.
And there was a whole nother GitHub for Mac that was Objective-C, I assume?
Yes, that's right.
Wow. So yeah, you totally had two completely separate code bases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then they both use different APIs, because you've got OctoKit, which is the GitHub API. Is that right?
Yeah, and so that's been the other fun part of my job is the open source work. So as we were building out these apps, we spun out various sorts of frameworks that we thought that other people would get a kick out of. Reactive Cocoa and Reactive UI were projects that came out of this stuff around doing functional reactive programming in Cocoa and in C#. OctoKit became sort of our banner for GitHub API clients. I got involved with the .NET client. There is a Objective-C client as well. There was a Ruby one as well. So they're officially supported GitHub API wrappers for programming language that you use. So you don't need to learn about the HTTP internals of the GitHub API. You just use the C# or Objective-C code that you like. And yeah, we've open sourced those up and we've had people get involved with those from the community as well. That's, yeah, lots of what I do for most of the day.
So aside from just OctoKit. So OctoKit talks to the REST APIs on github.com, the website, right?
Yes.
So you've also got to talk to the Git repositories. And so how did that change? Because you've got to have, do you talk to Git itself? Do you use a library like libgit2? How do you do that?
Okay, so this is something that came up. It's actually changed my philosophy on this over time. There's two general approaches with Working with your Git repositories is whether you want to do things in process or out of process. The benefits of this, which we can get to it in a bit before, but originally with the desktop apps, we would use libgit2 and then language wrappers on top of that. So libgit2 is lovely because it's all done in memory. It's essentially a thin wrapper on top of some native APIs to then pull Git data out of your repository. The downside to this is that you're working with stuff in the current process. And so if you have a really, really large repository, the problems can basically doing your Git operations can take away from the actual memory that's being used for the rest of your app. And lots of people, you know, they don't like applications using gigabytes of memory. And so we've kind of just changed our philosophy with the desktop Electron app to be shelling out to Git. So this is nice because it gives us a bit of separation between the app and the Git repository. And the OS is very good at, you know, creating processes and tearing things down. And so it becomes a bit more of separation. And the really nice thing about this as well is that when we update to a later version of Git, we get all the same features that the Git command line does. Whereas projects like libgit2, they're kind of stuck behind because they can't quite reuse all the Git code. They have to kind of go and implement stuff from scratch. And so we're very much up with all the latest Git stuff in desktop because it's nice. And then we can use things like you would regular command line.
Very cool.
When you did the change, were you, so is there a JavaScript like OctoKit? Is there one of those for talking to GitHub?
There are some community ones out there,
right.
But the really controversial change was the Git usage.
Okay.
There is a project for doing Git operations using libgit2 in Node.js. It's called NoGit. We had some experience with this, but we decided not to use it because, again, like to do with the everything occurring in the context of the process, we wanted to avoid that stuff. And in previous apps, we would ship a version of the Git command line alongside, so we're familiar with packaging up Git and making it available to you, and so we decided to leverage that stuff and keep the things separate versus going back to the improc way of working with Git.
Okay. So when you made the change to the improc Git, one of the reasons why libgit2 was created was obviously because of improc Git has a, so git.exe or Git, I guess, has a habit of just dying if it encounters a problem and stuff, and that was one of the reasons why we went with, say, libgit2 inside of Visual Studio. So how do you handle that? And this is interesting, I know, because Visual Studio is also looking at Git.
So the Visual Studio team went down the same path as us a while ago, around they were using libgit2 and they switched out.
I was just kind of saying that.
So there's two different uses that come up for typical Git in applications. If you imagine Git servers like GitHub, Atlassian's, Bitbucket products, VSTS, they're very well optimized for a specific set of operations. And so this allows them to kind of tune the version of Git or libgit2 or whatever they want to use for their use case. Whereas on the client side, we have a bit more of a broad set of usages. And we decided that it was easier for us to kind of, rather than go and re-implementing things into libgit2, we can just use the stuff that's already there in Git because they are very familiar with working with Git repositories locally. That's kind of been the separation that I see in terms of the usages and why we changed our path with the Electron app.
Okay. I'm Martin. So when you call out to git.exe and it just sort of dies, does it? Is that what happens?
There's...
It just kind of, if it returns back an error, you tell the process is gone.
Yeah. So Git and exit codes is a lovely sort of can of worms, let's put it that way. But ultimately, generally, we just assume that, like, if Git gives you a non-zero exit code, there's going to be some scenarios that you need to handle, and you kind of back that into your application code so that you either handle it and just continue on, or you fail hard and they use it to do something. The common one is like 128. That means authentication failed, the repository's not there, you don't rely on exit codes. You should also look at the actual output from Git. And so there's a lot of plumbing stuff that you do need to build up on top that you wouldn't get with if you were using something like libgit2.
So you just kind of pop up a dialog box that contains the standard out or standard error from Git itself. Is that the idea?
For those ones that we don't really know how to handle, yeah.
Fair.
Yeah.
Huh. That makes sense.
As part of this desktop thing, I've built Node.js bindings on top of git.exe that do a lot of that plumbing handling. It's called Dugite, D-U-G-I-T-E. Yes, it's a weird name. It's got Git in it, and it doesn't affect the trademark side of things, but it's also a name of a very poisonous Australian snake. So, yeah.
Isn't everything in Australia poisonous, though?
Every animal.
every non-cute animal, yes.
And some even the cute ones are vicious, like those koala bears that got some claws on them.
Oh, wombats I would definitely like not mess with as well. They're very cute, but yeah.
Yeah, see, that's the thing about Europe, you know, our weather's never amazingly awesome, it's just mediocre the whole time, but at least the country isn't actively trying to kill you, so.
Also, when the UK, like, has an actual heat wave, it goes up to, like, 30 degrees Celsius, and I just laugh, because, like, that's good weather.
Right. Yeah, no, I was in Vegas the other week, and it was a little bit warmer there than I was used to, so, anyway, but, yeah, okay. So, now, Ed and I... So we've written a lot of different like UIs for version control tools in our time, not just getting stuff. When I've parsed command line outputs in the past, there's often been an option that you can pass into the input parameter of the command line to get it to give you a more machine parsable output. Is there anything like that in Git, or does that not exist in Git?
There is the concept of the porcelain output. So -z is a general argument that you can pass in everywhere. That'll give you essentially null delimited lines, and so you don't need to worry about parsing lines. It's also a much more structured output versus like the user-friendly output that you get from Git. Yes, there's lots of those flags that you can turn on Git to make the output more easier to parse.
But no JSON or, I don't know, even XML or something?
No JSON. I did see the NPM lets you output JSON by passing in a JSON flag, which is kind of nice for like diffing outputs between two. I don't know if Git cares about that stuff, but I think the stuff that's there is reasonable enough for apps to build up on.
Okay.
Yeah, and I wrote a command line once for version control tool for TFVC, and it gave you output a type of XML. That's how old school we were back then.
Wow, that's dating you too.
Yeah, I think there was a JSON option as well eventually, was there? I don't even know. But
I don't know. JSON didn't even, I mean, JavaScript barely existed back in those days.
Yeah. Speaking about JavaScript, when you did the... one of the things, so Microsoft Visual Studio Code is based on Electron, and one of the reasons why they did that is it actually allowed them to reuse some of their assets they'd already created for the web. And so the main editor control inside of Visual Studio Code is a thing called Monaco, which is open source as well, which is a, you know, an editor. So were you able to reuse any UI assets or UI skills from inside of GitHub? Because obviously, you know, you guys know about websites.
Yes. So specifically, we kind of went with the apps to be visually different from GitHub, but we do steal some things behind the scenes to make sure that, like, so things like colors we bring across from the GitHub website. We haven't done any bulk or sort of like pulling in of assets at this point, but maybe as we do more stuff for the UI, there'll be things that overlap. The benefit that we have at the moment with the UI being cross-platform is that because Electron is running on top of Chromium, which is essentially the public open source version of the Chrome browser, is that we get to reuse the same styles for the Mac and Windows apps from the same source ultimately. This isn't something we were able to do with the classic apps because of their different UI technologies and them coming together. We had to kind of choose something weird in between if we were to go down that path. But ultimately, like, we have this app that looks, we tweak things for the platforms themselves, but yeah, the same source output for both platforms, and people are already running it up on Linux, so we don't need to worry about that stack there. Yeah, the Electron benefits UI-wise have been fantastic.
Interesting. So you had two apps. You had GitHub for Mac, you had GitHub for Windows, and really you burned them down, right? You started over with an Electron app. You know, this is...
It was so, kind of a last resort.
Really?
I'll just jump in, sorry.
Yeah.
We looked at other cross-platform things. The big thing that we wanted to do was find an alternative that would give us a lot of reuse. And in terms of, like, there were lots of... We had a very simple list of stuff, but all the things that we came through just didn't quite line up to it. And ultimately, the rework to kind of bring it in something else UI-wise, yeah, we kind of just went, all right, what would this thing look like if we started from scratch? And so we started on a little Skunkworks thing. We started with one person and then two, and then I got pulled in. And yeah, it was about 12 months of work just for like a team of four on top of doing existing things. And yeah, it was ready enough to show, and people are using it now. I do feel bad that it was a rewrite, but we literally tried everything else and we couldn't find something good enough.
Yeah, I know. I mean, so, you know, Fred Brooks called this the second system effect, right? in mm-hmm. in his book, The Mythical Man Month. And Joel Spolsky said that this, you know, rewriting your first app over again is something that you should never do, right? Like, he's got a whole blog post about how this never works out, but it's worked out for you. Why did it work out for you when it works so poorly for everybody else?
We had to switch technologies is probably the big
thing. Okay.
So we didn't take the same code and go elsewhere. We had to kind of start from scratch on a blank canvas. And I think that led us to questioning a lot of the assumptions that we made previously and ultimately setting on something that we could do from one code base versus like the two there. Like, so we were kind of, you could say we were writing two systems, but we were also killing off two systems at the same time. So I see that like there was a net benefit there of going down this path, and we proved things out internally first and then before making this thing public. Like, yeah, I do appreciate the concerns about second system, but or second system rather, but yeah.
And then in terms of installer technologies, what do you use? Because you used to, yeah, what do you use for installers? Because obviously the Mac installation mechanism is very, very different to the Windows
one. So Electron comes with its own updating framework called Squirrel. This is named for the Squirrel.Mac project and the Squirrel.Windows project. They're open source updating libraries for Mac and Windows respectively. And so we just leverage those as part of the installation and update. If you've ever used Click Once, that's the experience that Squirrel is there for. Click Once, for those of you who haven't played around with Windows recently, they make it so that the average user can install things. It's very low dependency. It doesn't require elevation, and then updates should just work. Like, it takes care of lots of all the friction, and then you just have a little update server that takes care of serving up your artifacts to the Electron app, and everything should just work.
So is that true of Squirrel too? You don't need elevation to install. So do I just as a normal user, I can install GitHub Desktop?
Correct.
Wow.
That's been the goal, and that's why we chose Click Once for the Windows app back in the day, because it was baked into Windows and users don't need to have permissions to install into program files. That touches on those people who do love to install things into program files, and I know Visual Studio Code switched away from Squirrel for doing these updates because people wanted to install things into program files. But that was a philosophical decision that we made, and we've kind of stuck to.
Cool.
So you mentioned Visual Studio Code. We've talked about it a couple times now. VS Code, of course.
To be fair, it was me that mentioned VS Code, but anyway. Yeah.
Well, okay. I think we've all mentioned it at this point. And of course, VS Code is just a lightweight, you know, cross-platform text editor written in Electron. It shares some of the same architecture as GitHub Desktop. One of the things that is unique, I think, to VS Code, and again, this kind of goes back to its heritage of the Monaco text editing widget, if you will. VS Code is written entirely in TypeScript. It's actually, you know, compiled into or transpiled, whatever you want to say, into JavaScript from a statically typed JavaScript derivative called TypeScript. Are you guys writing JavaScript? And are you guys writing TypeScript? What are you guys using?
That's a fun question. So out of the team who's working on desktop, we have one person whose background is Mac and three people whose background is Windows. So you think of what language you'd be using that stuff. You'd be talking about Objective-C, you'd be talking about C#. Like, those languages there have a lovely, strong compiler experience. And when you mess up, they get very noisy at you. Switching over to JavaScript was very much a big culture change. So the Atom team does some stuff with JavaScript as well. And like, we kind of leaned on them a bit for their input. But we ended up choosing, settling on one of two options. The first one was TypeScript, as you talked about, and the other one was Flow. TypeScript is a bit more upfront setup work to get going, whereas Flow is a bit more you add things to your existing JavaScript file and the linting experience, you know, flows from that. Like, they're the two projects and they're kind of different in philosophy. But we kind of chose TypeScript because the experience on Windows was a lot nicer than Flow at the time. And ultimately, the tooling experience was really nice to get things set up. It worked in Atom and VS Code for getting stuff going. I haven't used Visual Studio in a fair while for doing anything work-related. I kind of miss a little bit, but ultimately, yeah, I do a bunch of stuff in VS Code and Atom around this development experience. And yeah, the TypeScript stuff is really nice in terms of JavaScript, but with a bit of a whole bunch of syntax on top of it, so that you do get a whole bunch of more linting and verification of the code before things run up.
So, wow, I didn't realize that the team was three Windows devs and one Mac dev. I just guess I would have thought it was two and two, you know, naively. But how has everybody managed the transition from moving to, you know, Objective-C and C# into TypeScript? I mean, there are so many like little platform differences. So when I wrote UI tools for version control, they were all cross-platform, and we had to do things like make sure that the OK button was in the right place on every platform and stuff like that. How do you deal with that in Electron? Can you? Can you deal with that? Do you get control over the dialogues?
Okay, so you could do your own dialogues in Electron, or you could actually use the APIs that Electron provides. And they will then shell out to, whether it's on Mac or Windows or Linux, the operating system APIs for opening files, saving files. There's things around certificates as well. There's a whole bunch of stuff built into Electron that we haven't had to write as part of doing the desktop app, and we can just leverage those. Updater APIs are there. There's shell APIs for opening files out. Lots of these things that we kind of deal with in terms of an app that works with files and needs to interact with the operating system. Yeah, there's stuff already there. There was some certificate APIs that weren't there in Electron that we needed. The scenario that comes up with people evaluating GitHub Enterprise, they want to test it with a self-signed certificate. By default, if you were to use this in an Electron app or in your browser, you would have to go and then trust the certificate. Those APIs weren't there in Electron, and so myself and another person added in those APIs, and then they were available as part of the release. Having that sort of like framework for the whole app being open source, I know you guys both work for Microsoft, that stuff has been fantastic because we can move as quickly as we can, and if we wanted to, we could run our own fork of Electron just to kind of get that stuff in. But yes, open source everywhere.
Very cool. Hey, just switching gears a little bit. So again, around the version control space, it's probably like four different types of source control user, and they're managing their interactions with source control, and they all think theirs is the right way and everybody else is insane. So you've got the command line person, you've got the graphical UI person, who probably is also, you know, likes the web UI a lot. Then you've got the IDE person, somebody who likes to use source control with inside of their development environment, if they're used to using something like Visual Studio or Eclipse or IntelliJ or whatever. And then finally you have, and I don't know if this is a special beast on Windows, probably is, you have the people who like the shell integration, so like the people who came from Tortoise SVN. So your GitHub desktop kind of fills the graphical UI space. Do you agree? Is that kind of alongside things like Git Tower and Git Kraken or not? Or is it more about GitHub?
I would, but I'd also contextualize a little bit better. So the kind of users that we think about when we're building out our stuff is a bit more also the experience with Git. Mm-hmm. So you might have people who have no idea what Git is and they just want to get stuff done. They are scared of the command line and they want to like new experience. Mm-hmm. Power users who will happily jump between command line and UI based on what they're doing. There's lots of like archetypes for people, and for the most part, the desktop team thinks a lot about those people who are getting started with Git, because quite often they're getting started with GitHub at the same time as they are getting started with Git. And so we want to make that experience very nice. We also kind of want those people who are doing a lot of the common day-to-day stuff, we want to make that stuff really fast and really easy to do.
What sort of things do you mean common day-to-day stuff, Brennan?
So creating a branch, making some commits, you know, pushing up a pull request to GitHub, like making that flow really easy. And so you can just do all that stuff within the UI.
Okay.
I'm not part of the we have a team at GitHub around editor tools experience, and they've been dealing with Visual Studio. They've got an open source extension for that that does GitHub things on top of Git itself. Unity, they added Git integration there and GitHub integration as part of, they announced it at GDC this year. Like, there's those people as well who they focus on, and they're a bit more GUI-driven people, but they're also dealing with specific tasks.
And you have folks that do the Java side as well, don't you? Who help out with some of those toolings. But we don't do a UI as much.
I'm not sure. Yeah. I'd have to cast my memory back.
Kevin Zawicki, I remember, used to do a lot of that stuff back in the day. I don't know if he still does.
Yes. Oh, good old Kevin. Yeah. I don't know what's happened with that side, but yes, if people care, they can bug me on Twitter and I can chase things up.
So on the UI side, what things do you think people struggle with most? Is it literally getting started using Git, or is it getting connected to GitHub? What is the main things that you want to help people with?
the common thing that I see with people who are getting started with Git is that they get overwhelmed by concepts. Knowing about the index and knowing that you have to stage commits before doing that, like there's very Git specific things that come up that people will just go, why do you do that? The flip side of that is you'll also have users who want the full control of Git in their UI. And so there's a whole bunch of very sort of GUI clients that go with different philosophies. But our goal is to just show you enough version of enough of Git to get things going. In the past, we've diverged a bit from Git terminology. My favorite story is the sync button. The sync button is a little magic button in the classic Mac and Windows apps that lets you pull down, merge changes, you know, get everything up to date without having to think about things. It's lovely when it works. And sometimes when it breaks, you're left at this point where you're not quite sure what you're supposed to do. So we made a conscious decision with the desktop app to not do the sync button and have it as showing a bit more of the fetch, push, and pull experience that would be like Git, but also making it more helpful to understand what's going to happen when you push the button.
Got you.
So are users happier now that, so, you know, you've kind of given them a more Git command line sort of experience, or at least in terms of terminology, are users happier, or do they understand better what this does? Because, I mean, you said sync, and I don't even know what it does. I have no idea what the sync button would do, or if something went wrong, how to get myself out of it. So
it tries various sorts of versions of pull first off. Like, that's, yeah, I need to go and look at the source code to understand what it was doing. It's that intimidating, but
exactly.
It's a bit of magic that some people love.
Yeah, it would do a pull with a merge, wouldn't it? And then it would do a push or something like that. I seem to remember, but anyway.
It's like pull with rebase,
yeah.
And if
doesn't work,
you do a pull with merge, and if that doesn't work, you're stuck in a merge conflict. Nice. Like, it's that sort of flow, and when it breaks really hard. Coming back to the original question about do people find it more easy to understand, I do believe so. So like in the desktop app, when you have changes coming down, you'll see like, hey, there's a pull and there's like a number of commits. So you can see like, hey, I want to pull that stuff into my branch. Like we still show you enough context around what's going to happen, but we use the Git terminology so that it's translatable between the GUI and the command line.
So people can go on Stack Overflow and they get confused?
possibly. No comment.
And then you manage, as well as doing, you know, the day job, which involves working with a bunch of open source, you was, you know, shift key out in the universe, do a bunch of open source work yourself. How do you, how do you manage that, first of all? Because you have an insane amount of productivity. Like,
not sure how I manage it. So I generally find myself doing open source projects that line up with things that are relevant to work.
Okay.
That's the best way to kind of justify my time being spent. So I've been involved with projects like Reactive UI in the past that we used in the existing classic Windows app. I've used libgit2, and I've been involved with libgit2 sharp as well in the past because they were used in the app. But then it always kind of gets hard when your focus on work changes. Mm. And so like, I'm no longer doing C# at work, so it's hard to justify my time for those sorts of projects. And so hopefully I can then helpfully get someone else on board to help out. Reactive UI has been really successful. They've got a whole bunch of people that have jumped up and they're moving things along now. Libgit2, thank you, Ed, for jumping back on that. I don't have a secret formula. I mostly just make it up as I go along. Reactive Extensions is another one that I found myself inheriting that I'm not sure what I'm going to do with. Yes, I don't have more than 24 hours in the day as everyone else does.
People like, you mentioned Squirrel earlier, like Paul Betts is insane as well, the amount of stuff that he gets done.
I don't know how he does it.
I don't either, but I want to buy stock in whatever coffee he drinks.
He's done a whole bunch of projects as part of the work at Slack with their Electron app as well, and I just couldn't keep up with all the stuff that he was open sourcing. It's, kids, don't try this at home.
So with somebody getting started with Git, what would be your, other than obviously, go install GitHub Desktop and that'll give you an awesome experience on Windows and Mac, especially if you're talking to GitHub. What should people do to get started? Where should people go to learn? What do you need to know before you start using Git properly?
So I've done a few sort of like booth attendances as part of my work at GitHub, and we have a cheat sheet at those booths, which is this lovely sort of two-pager for like the Git commands that match up with like doing common actions. I'll give you guys a link in the show notes for that stuff. It's not only a lovely handy sheet, but it's also translated into languages that aren't English. So for those people who English is their second language, there's translations for this stuff as well. It's just a lovely sort of thing to have on your desk to kind of go like, oh, what's the commands for doing, you know, trying to merge a branch again? Like, it'll show you that stuff, and so you can get familiar with the command line experience. But other than that, I would happily recommend the desktop app for people getting started, because that's the experience that we focus on.
Very cool. Ed, do you have questions as we're starting to wrap up the show?
Yeah, I know what GitHub Desktop does kind of, you know, at a big picture. You know, you said you can, you know, check out branches, you can merge branches. Are there GitHub specific interactions in GitHub Desktop? What cool things can I do with github.com, the website, from within GitHub Desktop? Can I create a pull request?
Yes, at the moment. Technically GitHub Desktop Electron app is in public beta. So we're trying to catch up to 1.0, which is essentially the parity with the existing apps, so that we can then help deprecate those. But creating a pull request is available in the UI. It's a link out to the website now, but we're going to make the experience a whole bunch better. So GitHub-related things that come up around doing your code, that's stuff that we care about, and we're going to be working on post 1.0 once we catch our breath. There's also ability to quickly compare your branch on GitHub to an arbitrary reference. Maybe we'll get more of that stuff into the app itself, so you don't need to shell out or jump out to GitHub rather. But the experience there is, like, whether you're on GitHub or GitHub Enterprise, you know, being able to kind of clone down a repository, make some changes, push them up to GitHub, do the GitHub flow around then opening a pull request to get things reviewed and merged. Lots of that stuff you can do in the app already.
That's one of the things I see users of UIs with Git struggle with the most, is kind of understanding the difference between my local repo and my remote repo, and what state the remote repo is in, you know, without having to go browse to the site separately. And being able to see all that from one UI is pretty
especially for repositories with lots of activity, it's very hard to keep your local up to date, even behind the scenes, and knowing that you're a fair bit behind. Making that clear in a visual way is something that we're still thinking about as a team, because we had some attempts at this with the Classic app that had mixed sort of results. But yes, the visual side of things, I think, is a lovely thing for GUI tools to fill out, especially if they sit there within you know, your editor.
So GitHub obviously has a very deep API surface area, you know, over on the github.com. Do you see a point where the desktop client's actually encouraging the introduction of new APIs in github.com to facilitate some of these, you know, client server type interactions and things?
I don't have much to point to in terms of that. We were involved with dogfooding a bunch of the GraphQL stuff that rolled out. So for those of you who haven't kept up, the next version of GitHub API will be GraphQL based. This is kind of a big deal, because the version that's currently out there is hypermedia driven, which is lovely in terms of dealing with pagination and the querying side of things. GraphQL was a big change from that, but it lets you optimize for lots of specific things around your use case. And so I was involved with that from the team side, and like doing some dogfooding before we got launched out. For general features, we have open requests with the team for getting stuff done. And there are things that are website specific that we would love to do in the apps, but I don't have any secrets to give you at this point, I'm afraid.
No, that's cool. I just interested if it's going to change, you know, if you see it changing the direction. But another question. Apologies. You used to work at GitHub, Ed, so this probably doesn't make sense to you. But how kind of is GitHub structured in terms? So you've got the GitHub Desktop team, and then it's like a server team and a backend team, or is it an API team, or how does that kind of work?
The website team is kind of structured around features that they're working on at the moment. So I've not kept up over that over the last couple of months, but I sit over on the client app side. So this is the team that looks after Electron, Atom, Desktop, Editor Tools. Like, we're all the same people, because we kind of deal with the same sort of like problem space, dealing with, you know, people's tools they install on their machine, things that complement the GitHub experience. Like, that's where I kind of hang out at GitHub these days. Lovely bunch of people all kind of scattered around the world, so we talk about things in a fairly distributed way. The website team and the operations team, they're fairly bigger as well as us.
But they're the ones keeping, like, github.com, the thing that most of us see.
Yes, the rolling out the new features of the website, supporting the Git hosting of the repositories, making sure everything is up and working smoothly. Yeah, that's, I don't have to worry about that much.
Yeah, which is good. You don't get the call at night, you know, when things go horribly wrong, which it's nice not to be on that team anymore, isn't it, Ed? That's one of the good things about what we do.
That's right.
Time zones are terrible enough for me. I don't want to do operations as well.
Yeah. And then I'll shut up, I promise. In terms of getting the updates, when you send out an update to GitHub Desktop, you're finding, I know Squirrel automatically picks those up for you, and you're finding good adoption of new versions and things, like people aren't requesting, hey, how do I stop updates from coming down and all that sort of stuff?
No. So the general philosophy we've had with the updates is that they just keep rolling forward. And so behind the scenes, like, you'll just get the version updated to the app, you might get prompted to restart things, but that's been our philosophy with the apps for the longest time, because ultimately you want to be on the new stuff, because you'll get fixes and security things and new shiny stuff. That philosophy has worked for us lovely. Generally, like, if something comes up that's, you know, mission critical, we can roll that update quickly to make sure that people are up to date. But for the most part, yeah, people just pull in updates whenever the client's ready.
Very cool.
How often is that? How often do you release a new version of the client?
At the moment with the beta side, we've been doing things sort of like weekly. Esque. Wow. Early on, we were doing a lot of, like, as part of the public launch, we were just like, you know, new update each day, monitor that, fix things up, triage things out. But we're at the point where we're doing things, roughly weekly updates. We did an update yesterday, and we'll probably do another one if there's enough to roll up, like, beginning of next week. As we get closer to 1.0, we'll probably start stabilizing. People have asked us for, like, a beta channel versus, like, a stable channel, and so we don't abuse the stable channel, and we've got that rolling out at the moment to test, and we'll make that publicly available soon for those people who are brave.
Yeah, right now everybody's on the beta channel.
Oh, no.
Probably are. Anyway.
But technically, yes. Yeah.
Oh, the beta channel is truly beta.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, people are running the reasonably latest stuff. All the updating things just work behind the scenes.
So do you have good analytics then coming back from the clients? Like, you said you were updating every day and fixing bugs as you saw them. Do people have to report those, or do you get, like, crash dumps coming to, for me, I'm at Microsoft, it's App Insights, but do you have something like that?
So we've got something similar, and it's essentially what we call Central. So Central deals with our updates and the reporting of crash things, and we feed that into a little analytics portal that lets us see, you know, what versions have got crashes, and we have correlation around, hey, a Yo user with this identifier encountered this error a few times. Like, we can correlate a whole bunch of stuff around the app that's running at the moment, which is nice because users, for the most part, won't come and report to you things unless they're really passionate about it. And so finding those things behind the scenes and just being able to fix things up quietly without interrupting the users does make everyone's lives a lot easier.
Wow, that's really cool. So when you turn on the beta channel, you will really be able to get, like, live up to the minute crashes and be able to fix them as soon as they happen. That's amazing.
Yes, we also get that for the same.
I'm going to hold you to that if I ever see it crash.
No, I thought that joke was going somewhere else, but yeah.
Oh, wait. Oh, no.
Yeah, we're about to start wrapping up, Brendan. Where can people find you and the amazing work you do on the interwebs? And then, you know, where should people go to learn more about GitHub Desktop and GitHub?
Yeah. So my website is brendanforster.com that I never update. The more interesting things are probably going to be on Twitter. I am ShiftKey there, and I'm also ShiftKey on GitHub if you want to follow along with all my Kong adventures. The desktop project is at desktop.github.com. If you want to dive in there, there's links to documentation and the actual open source project itself. I think that's all the interesting stuff, and I'll give you the links for the training materials around getting started with GitHub that I'm a big fan of.
Fantastic.
Awesome. Well, thanks for joining us, Brendan. This has been wonderful. I'm really excited to learn about GitHub Desktop.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and everybody, give it a try.
Absolutely.
Okay, fantastic. Well, thanks very much, Brendan, and thanks very much for your time.
Yes, it was a pleasure.
So that's it, Martin. That's our first episode in the bag.
Show number one in the can. Let's go find some theme music.
That's right.
Okay, we'll see you all next time.
And thanks again. We'll see you again.
Take care.